I remember once I was in Leeds in Yorkshire, and at that time there was a very famous Scottish scholar connected with the Sunday School movement, Alexander Smalley was his name. And then there was a very famous Bible teacher at Keswick, Graham Sproggie. You may have read his books. And then, of course, this famous evangelist, George Grubb. And they ever had this convention in Leeds. It said, Smalley, Sproggie, and Grubb. And I thought, what a kettle of fish. But when we started preaching, he had phenomenal response. Benjamin Franklin said his preaching was the most powerful he'd ever heard. Benjamin Franklin once was talking to George Whitfield. Whitfield said, I'm going to start an orphanage in Savannah. Franklin said, you're crazy. Not Savannah, way down there. Philadelphia is the center of all the colonies. Now you build it here and I'll help you financially. Whitfield said, God has spoken to me and I'm going to start it in Savannah. So Benjamin Franklin said, he's not going to get any money from me. Now he went to one of these meetings and he saw that George Whitfield was going to take up a collection for his orphanage. He said in his pocket he had a $5 gold piece, some silver dollars, and some copper. But he determined not to give anything. He didn't approve. But when the plague was passed, he relented and decided to put in the copper. George Whitfield was preaching so powerfully, he decided, well, I'll give him the silver as well. And finally, he put in gold, silver, and copper, and everything. He said, that man could really preach. Now, you may be surprised to know that Dwight Lyman Moody was not an educated man. He couldn't spell to save his life. He spelled orthodox, O-T-H-E-D-E-X, orthodox. But occasionally said, how do you spell Philadelphia? F-I-L-A, what comes after that? You say, well, when you read Moody's sermons, you don't find this out. Oh, no. Christians during the Victorian age always smooth things over a little bit. They felt it wouldn't be glorifying to the Lord if you allowed Moody's bad spellings to get into his books. So he always had someone to edit them. But Moody was not an educated man. I would have loved to have heard George Whitfield preach. In those days, there was no amplification, no loudspeakers. You know that when Whitfield was crossing the Atlantic, and those little sailing ships, they would form like a V of ducks for a convoy, for protection against the wind, to help each other if a storm came up. And it was a calm Sunday, because it took a month or more to come across, it was a calm Sunday, Whitfield would conduct divine worship for the fleet. He had such a voice, he could lead worship from the leading ship to the whole ship and all the ships present. When he preached in Philadelphia at the Custom House steps, crowds used to gather across the river in New Jersey to listen to him. Benjamin Franklin was no fool. He was a mathematician. He calculated by pi r squared and all the rest of it that the total number listening to Whitfield's unaided voice was 20, and he said he could reduce an audience to tears by the way he pronounced the word Mesopotamia. Now, in England, John Wesley, when he was a student, belonged to a little club. They were called the Bible Moths. The nickname that stuck most was the Methodists. They went to communion every day. They visited the sick. They fasted. They had a method of living. It was all works, works, works. But they meant them. And that's where the name Methodist came from. It was a nickname. But the first to be converted in that group was George Whitfield. He worked so hard at it, he got ill. And while he was in bed, he read a book called The Life of God and the Soul of Man by a man called Henry Scrugal. And this book upset him. Scrugal said, religion is not a lot of duties and exercises. It's the life of God in your soul, union with God. And as a result of that, George Whitfield was converted. After Wesley came back from America, he was very unhappy. He had met a Moravian missionary on the ship. And he told the missionary, I just don't have the faith. And Peter Bowler said something to him that was very strange. He said, preach faith until you have it. In other words, don't give up the ministry, but preach it until you get it yourself. Now one night, John Wesley went to St. Paul's Cathedral, that lovely cathedral in London, and the choir sang a magnificent number. He went to a prayer meeting at Aldersgate Street afterwards, and someone was reading from Luther's introduction to the epistle to the Romans. And suddenly it dawned on John Wesley that sins were forgiven. Now it's strange today, when something like that dawns on our soul, we show it in certain ways, don't we? They fell to their knees and sang, "We praise thee, O God, we acknowledge thee to be the Lord." Those old-fashioned words. And from that time on, John Wesley became a powerful preacher of the gospel. There was a young atheist who went to hear Mr. Moody preach. Moody called upon a Presbyterian minister to lead him in prayer. The man had never prayed before 25,000 before. He got sort of carried away. Now, I once heard an Irishman say, if a man prays for 3 minutes, you pray with him. If he prays for another 3 minutes, you pray for him. And if he prays for another 3 minutes, you pray against him. This good brother had been praying for quite a long time, and Mr. Moody got up and said, while our brother is finishing his prayer, let's sing hymn number 11. And the young atheist said, there's an honest man. He came back the next night, but Moody wasn't preaching there the next night. The Cambridge Seven were there, and he was converted. You know that John Wesley, a very godly young man, went to be a chaplain in Georgia, in the colony at Savannah. But he fell in love with a girl there. He couldn't bring himself to propose. He was a very introspective sort of fellow. The girl waited patiently to see what he was going to do, and then on the rebound she married somebody else. What did John Wesley do? He refused to let this girl and her husband come to communion. He was asked why. He said, because she's a hypocrite. What do you mean she's a hypocrite? Well, she loves me and she married him. The husband had a warrant sworn out for his arrest. And John Wesley decided that discretion was the better part of valor. He got on a horse and didn't stop galloping until he reached Philadelphia. Then he took ship for England. You might call that prevenient grace. He was a great horseman after that. When John Wesley got back to England, he met George Whitefield. And he said, I'm thinking of going to America. And John Wesley said, don't go. It's hopeless there. But they drew lots. And George Whitefield decided to come. When a young man came in, Moody saw he was one of the ringleaders of the riot 2 nights before. So he said, what can I do for you, sir? He said, Mr. Moody, I was one of those who thought that you were singularly unequipped to speak to gentlemen. But sir, he said, as I observed you on the platform, I came to the conclusion that you were the only gentleman in the meeting. Sir, he said, I wish to apologize. It was a British sense of fair play. There was a very strong sense of fair play. You know, when somebody fumbles the ball in a rugby game, the spectator shout, hard luck, sir. When he hits the ball, they shout, well played, sir. What do we do over here? Throw him out. So Gerald Anders said, Mr. Moody, I wish to apologize. Moody shook his hand. He said, I'll forgive you if you come to the rest of the meetings. And Gerald Anders sat in the front. Moody waited 5 minutes before giving any kind of invitation. The first man forward was Gerald Ander. He became Bishop of Hong Kong. Moody turned that university upside down. But the revival began through prayer meetings. Sydney editors reported a call for prayer. They said it would be a happy day for Sydney and New South Wales when a similar influence visits us here. The extraordinary revival began in Melbourne. It began in the town of Brighton. And before long it spread to Melbourne itself, great meetings in the city theatres following the London pattern. The Theatre Royal in Melbourne was crowded out Sunday by Sunday with 50,000 attending a dozen services. The congregations were very large and attentive, and yet regular worship services were not hurt in any way. The revival spread to South Australia. The Reverend J.D. Whittaker, pastor in a town called Coringa, announced 500 conversions in 3 months in the most glorious revival of religion, never such a one seen in this colony before. Great revivals in the Victorian goldfields, revival services full of holy zeal and fire. Revival in Bendigo and Ballarat, revival in Geelong. Revival spread to other parts, to Tasmania, especially in the Tasmanian capital, Hobart, following a week of prayer conducted by Spencer Williams. There was a 50% increase in membership among the Tasmanian Methodists in a single year. Then a most remarkable thing happened. William Taylor, who was known as California Taylor, who had come out with the settlers of the time of the Gold Rush, was busy in the eastern states in the United States during the 1858 revival. And after some ministry in the States, he made his way to Australia and got there in 1863. He became the great harvester of the revival, winning tens of thousands of people to Christ, most of whom joined the Methodists, but some other denominations. Those 7 fruitful years in Australia showed an increase among the Anglicans of 22%, Presbyterians 25%, Methodists 72%, Congregations 20%, Baptists 40%, and Lutherans 55%, although that was partly due to German immigration after the Crimean War. He said to me, "How do you distinguish between revival and successful evangelism?" Well, I said, it's like this. When D.L. Moody was in Toronto, 1884, practically every church in Toronto was blessed. But there wasn't anything much happening in Buffalo or Cleveland or Chicago or Philadelphia or Montreal. In other words, the blessing of God followed Moody's ministry. But in the 1858 revival, there was a revival in every city in the United States and Canada. That's the difference. He said, D.P. Thompson said, it's exactly the same as what happened in Scotland. When Moody came to Scotland in 1873, there was a revival everywhere. But when he came back in the 1880s, there was blessing in his campaign in Edinburgh, and then expectation and blessing in Glasgow, and then in Aberdeen, and Belfast, Dublin, and so forth. So we've got to distinguish between an outpouring of the Holy Spirit in general revival and the blessing of God upon a very faithful evangelist. Now some people say, well, why do we have to talk about these things that happened such a long time ago? Very simple. The scripture tells us to tell our children and our children's children what God has done. Why? That they might not forget his commandments. They might put their trust in God. He will answer in due course. You'll find many, many times revival has broken out among God's people when they heard of what God has done and what God can do.